Omaha Public Radio presents another program from Project Interfaith on Noon Forum. We'll hear a lecture by Sumi London Kim, chaplain for the Buddhist community at Duke University and author of Blue Jean Buddha and The Buddha's Apprentices. She'll speak on the topic Blue Jean Buddha, Tracing the Generations of Buddhism in America. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evening, March 15, 2011, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of Project Interfaith, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the speaker is Beth Katz, Executive Director of Project Interfaith.
Sumi London Kim is the chaplain for the Buddhist community at Duke University and an ordained lay minister for Buddhist Families of Durham. She's published two books on the path of young Buddhists in the West, Blue Jean Buddha, 2001, and The Buddha's Apprentice in 2005, among other articles and chapters. After receiving a master's degree in Buddhist studies and Sanskrit from Harvard Divinity School, she was the associate director for the Barr Center for Buddhist Studies in Barre, Massachusetts. Originally raised in the Soto Zen tradition, she's been following the Theravada Vipassana lineage for the past 19 years. Her subspecialty in the Dharma world is on how to teach children, teens, and college students about meditation and Buddhism. She's working on a third book on practicing Buddhism to be published in Korea next May. Sumi and her husband, who is a native of Korea, a monk and a professor, have two children ages 2 and 4, so you can imagine she's quite busy, and live in Durham, North Carolina. We're so thrilled to have Sumi with us and are very excited to hear what she has to share with us. So please join me in giving a warm welcome to Sumi London Kim.
Good evening. I'm so pleased to be here with you this evening. And I would like to just give special thanks to the remarkable Beth Katz and her staff of Project Interfaith for having me here. What I'd like to do in our time together is to give you a sense of how Americans think about and practice Buddhism. But I don't want to do this as a lecture of facts and figures on the history of Buddhism in America. Instead, I want to tell you a story. It just so happens that the story of Buddhism in America can be seen very nicely in the way Buddhism has gone through four generations of my family, or perhaps because my kids are so young, we should say 3 1/4. But before I begin this story, let me provide a little bit of perspective. When I was a kid in the 70s, Buddhism was way out there on the edges of American society. There was almost nothing about Buddhism anywhere except for in remote bookstores or a few small centers in cities. And Buddhism was a religion that people with either big hair or long hair did. And here we are today, with Buddhism as a source of inspiration for a range of commercial and products and pop culture. Many of us are familiar with the words karma, dharma, samsara, nirvana, bodhisattva. And of course, if you walk into a Barnes & Noble today, you'll see shelves of books on Buddhism. And many of us are familiar with Buddhist celebrities. We still keep Mr. Woods in our pantheon. I'm 35 years old, and I've been amazed and amused to watch Buddhism go from being a sort of fringy thing to not quite mainstream, but more acceptable. So how did that happen? How did Americans become fascinated by Buddhism? Well, to understand this, we actually need to back up even further back than my own family's history, to about 135 years ago. In the mid-1800s, Japan was undergoing a very painful transformation from a pre-modern society to a modernized and fairly westernized one. And just as Japanese society was undergoing this transformation, so too was Japanese Buddhism trying to figure out its own place in this new landscape, new social landscape. Buddhism, had enjoyed being a state religion for hundreds of years. But in the face of modern sentiments, it now seemed anachronistic. And indeed, the Christian missionaries who came to Japan characterized Buddhism as backward, superstitious, polytheistic, and medieval. So in a sense, the Buddhist monks and leading intellectuals of that period, the Meiji period, found a very clever way to circumvent Christianity. What they said was that Buddhism was not a religion. Instead, Buddhism is a philosophy or a psychology, and even a kind of science. And this framework of psychology and philosophy and science drew from and therefore fit neatly with the ideas of modernity. So this is the kind of Buddhism that left Japan and came to America at the turn of the 20th century. One of the people who helped export this Buddhism to Westerners was a Japanese lay Buddhist named Iti Suzuki, who came to America in the 1890s and wrote prolifically about Zen in English. And just as Buddhism was making its way west, my great-grandfather was making his way east as a merchant marine. Eventually, my great-grandfather settled near San Francisco. And his early contact with Japanese culture must have made a deep impression on him, because by the early 60s, he was reading books by D.T. Suzuki, who I mentioned. And for my great-grandfather, who was a proclaimed atheist, this version of Zen really worked for him. This version of Zen that said, Buddhism is not a religion, but a philosophy. And my great-grandfather also started to do some meditation. My dad came to live with his grandfather when he was 4. And my dad remembers that when he would come home from school, his grandfather would try to get him to do some meditation. And so he'd say, Nick, go sit on that chair and count your breaths to 100. And my dad thought he could get around it by going like this. At which point he would get dizzy and his grandfather would say, slow down. So it didn't quite stick. I think my dad was a bit young. My dad also remembers that some of his grandfather's friends would come over to the house to discuss the readings that they were doing on Zen, and that they would close the curtains, which indicated there was something secretive for them. And I think that shows how far outside of the mainstream Buddhism was for Americans at that time. My dad didn't take up Buddhism because of his grandfather, who passed away when my dad was 13. But instead, he became interested when he met a charismatic teacher named Daniil Amos. And Daniil had learned Zen in what is now one of the most famous centers in America, the San Francisco Zen Center. This center was founded by another Suzuki, Shunryu Suzuki, and Daniil had also learned a slow form of martial arts called Tai Chi Chuan from a Chinese master who had emigrated to the Bay Area. So this teacher, Daniil, drew a number of college students as well as my teenage dad to him. And Daniil began teaching a combination of meditation for the mind and spirit and Tai Chi for the body. And at that time, it was a little unusual to find a Buddhist teacher who was integrating body and meditation in equal parts. Generally, Buddhists have ignored the body, not in all lineages, but in many of them. And in the early 70s, Daniil decided to leave the Bay Area because he felt that it was too saturated with other spiritual teachers, so the stereotype has some foundation, and relocated to the East Coast. One of the members used his trust fund, much to his parents' dismay, to buy a very large house. It was a four-story 42-room mansion with many acres of fields and an apple orchard that went down to a clear blue lake. And in the 70s, at least in the Northeast, the real estate market was really quite depressed. So despite the size, the house was really cheap. This house used to be an inn in the 1700s and later became a school for boys before it was more or less abandoned. Today you'll find quite a few Buddhist centers are located in former estates. And you'll also find Buddhist centers in Catholic monasteries, former Catholic monasteries, Protestant parishes, or Jewish synagogues, as some of the membership of those places declined and the properties became available. So Daniil began teaching Tai Chi at the college nearby where this was, and my mom was a student there, and she started to learn Tai Chi from him and then began coming over to the Zen Center, and there she met my dad, and they fell in love and were engaged. And then in July of 1974, they got married in a sort of Buddhistic way. And I was born a year later. Both my father's father and my mother's father were raised in Jewish homes, in Jewish immigrant homes. And as such, my parents are representative of many in their generation who came from Jewish or Catholic or other Protestant or Protestant lineages who became drawn to Buddhism. And now you'll find some people who will call themselves Jubu, or see if you can figure this one out, Yuyubu, Unitarian Buddhist. The Catholic one doesn't come out, Kathbu. No, doesn't sound good. My parents and the young people in this community were serious about pursuing enlightenment, and they dedicated themselves to it fully, feeling that there was nothing more important to do with your life than to get nirvana. But my parents didn't call themselves Buddhist. Like my great-grandfather's generation, they considered the Buddha's teachings not so much a religion, but a philosophy, a way of life, a psychology. And at the same time, though, they didn't think that Buddhism was something you merely dabbled in, but that it was an entire way of life, that they wanted to live fully. And to do this, my parents and their peers tried to recreate a Zen monastery. So what was life like at this quasi-monastery? Nobody had very much money, and so our simple lifestyle easily matched the call for a Zen asceticism. The meals were basic, clothes were handed down from older children to younger, and we shared our toys, not our toothbrushes. I learned from this environment that one can be happy with very little. And indeed, the fewer material possessions one had, the more one was able to enjoy the simple pleasures of life. And from an early age, I was not allowed to define myself by my hairstyle or the clothes that I wore or any personal preference. Instead, I was asked to define myself by how I conducted myself in community, by my kindness, and through mindful conduct. Everyone followed the same monastic-like schedule, rising at 5 in the morning, a habit I still cannot break, for 40 minutes of meditation. And then we practiced bowing and chanting the Heart Sutra in Japanese, followed by several minutes of intoning Om, Om. After this, do you think we had breakfast? No, we did Tai Chi for 45 minutes. And the rest of the day was spent working. The women tended to the huge garden in the summers, and the men tackled the many, many maintenance issues on the old house. At dinner time, the adults carried on in long conversations about non-attachment, non-self, and nirvana. In retrospect, I now understand that while this community identified with Japanese Zen, Soto Zen in particular, we actually practiced a synthesis of Eastern and a little bit of Western religion. I don't think Japanese Zen monks do Hindu oming or Tai Chi or celebrate Christmas or sing Christmas carols. So in some ways, although this community was trying to be as authentic as possible, in many ways it was creating something new. One of our most unique activities was something we did called Zen basketball. Believe me, there is no Zen basketball in a Japanese monastery, so it truly is an American adaptation. The idea is that you can be in a meditative frame of mind while in motion. Today, we might call this the zone or flow. You are entirely in the present moment, completely connected to your other teammates and master of your world. I think unknowingly, Daniil had anticipated Phil Jackson, Phil Jackson and Michael Jordan by a good 20 years. By the early 80s, my parents had four kids, and they were in their late 20s. And I think they began to see that this lifestyle in the Zen Center might not be sustainable for the indefinite future, and they decided to leave. And I do have to ask, just how does one raise children and seek nirvana at the same time? Real-world practicalities, such as the need for an education, fulfilling work, financial resources, those things need to be attended to. And as it turns out, my parents were very much like many other Western Buddhists in their ambivalence. They were straddling a quasi-monastic, quasi-lay way of life. And on the downside, they did neither very well, neither abandoning all attachments in pursuit of enlightenment, nor being a very good parent, and they would admit this. So, on the upside, I experienced a very intensive spiritual training from an early age. There's a lot to share about the years that followed that, but for the sake of time, I'll just sum it up by saying that my parents divorced soon after, and my younger brother and I went to live with my dad. My dad continued to create a rather monastic way of life in his home, too, and to teach us about Buddhism and other religious practices. But I do remember there were two very distinctive memories I have from this time in my life. My dad had explained a Buddhist teaching that there's no one thing or person or event in life that can satisfy us forever and ever. We are always restless, always searching to fulfill our desires. And I learned this acutely when one afternoon we had done 45 minutes of yoga, and then we got to the last pose, the full body relaxation, which I don't know about you, but it's my favorite part of the yoga. And, the first few seconds or minutes of that pose are really delicious. And so, we were in this pose. And just as we were going into this last pose, the phone rang and my dad said, "Oh, just keep resting. I'll be right back. I'm going to answer the phone." Well, after 20 minutes, he had not come back. And that comfortable feeling of being in full body relaxation became a little uncomfortable. I wanted to move, but I didn't want to disobey my dad. And after 40 minutes, it was actually painful to be resting. And at that moment, I realized what he had said earlier was true, that there's nothing, even the thing that seems most comfortable in the beginning, that provides a permanent happiness. Unfortunately, my dad did come back a few minutes later, and he said, oh, for God's sakes, move. But this realization taught me that it's pointless to seek fulfillment through acquisition, and that what was needed instead was to learn how to deal with that fundamental condition of discomfort, of suffering directly. Another time that I remember well, my dad had all four of us kids, and he said, let's have a contest. Whoever can hear the most sounds in a minute wins. And so we closed our eyes and listened as attentively as possible, and I, like a kind of a radar, I could hear sounds as far away as the street, across the yard, and as close as my own breath. And during that exercise, I realized that we miss out on so much of our experience simply because we're not paying attention. And conversely, by paying attention, we discover that the experience of the present moment is very, very rich. When I was 16, my dad was watching a documentary on PBS, a Bill Moyers special. And it was about meditation and healing. And some of the scenes took place at an organization called the Insight Meditation Society, which is located in Barre, Massachusetts, central Massachusetts. It was about an hour and a half from where we were living in Connecticut. And we decided to visit. And we liked the place. And so a few months later, my brother and I registered for a 9-day silent retreat, making us the youngest people there. And one thing I immediately liked about Vipassana is that everyone sits facing the Buddha altar, whereas in Zen, you sit facing the wall. And what I liked about this was that every once in a while, I could open my eyes and see other people meditating, judge them to be better than me, and then look at the Buddha and find some inspiration. The other thing I liked about Vipassana is that everything is done slowly, actually super, super slowly, whereas in Zen, everything is done quickly. And this just suits my personality better. I like to take it slow. Vipassana practice, which is a style of practice taught at this place, Insight Meditation, asks us to slow down so that we can observe our present moment experience in great detail. I remember on the night of the first retreat, that the teacher had us stand and slowly shift our weight from one foot and then over to the other foot, and to observe that in great detail. And I had this aha moment in which I could see how there were so many aspects to even a very simple experience, and that by attending to it, one's mind could be fully focused and in the present. A few years later, I started college, and there was no Buddhist group on campus, so I joined the Student InterVarsity Christian Fellowship, knowing almost nothing about what it was about. And I religiously attended all the Bible studies and the prayer groups, as well as church on Sundays. But I should probably confess that at least half the reason I went was because I had a crush on a guy in the group. Most of the people who came were white, but there were also Asians as well. And I was so naive, but this was the first time I had ever met Asian Christians. On the first night of worship, we got together on a Sunday night, and we sang songs of praise that were easy to learn, emotional, and had a contemporary tune and rhythm. And I felt really moved and inspired to be singing something in English, my own language, and to actually know what I was singing. And this was a huge departure from my childhood, because chanting in Japanese and Sanskrit, I really didn't know what it was about, and so I didn't feel very moved by what we were doing, and it wasn't very emotional either. Later, the students mingled over juice and snacks, and I felt very welcomed and appreciated. And I thought about becoming Christian, partly because it's a lot easier to find nice friends. Whereas in Buddhism in America, at least without the internet, it's very hard to find people. One of the most valuable things I learned from this community is how important it was to walk the spiritual path with friends. And I count that year with the evangelicals, as they turned out to be one of the most valuable experiences of my life. Foremost, I saw that at least some Christian groups know how to garner and retain their members through outstanding attention to welcoming newcomers, to social engagement, and to building community. And conversely, many Buddhist groups are quite asocial and don't emphasize cultivating the spiritual path through relationships. But by the fall of my sophomore year, I began to feel a longing to return to my roots. In a way, by venturing thoroughly into something that was so different from what I had known, I came to more deeply understand my native roots in Buddhism. And I began to meditate regularly for the first time in a number of years, just watching my mind. When I meditated, I realized that my mind is constantly chattering, like a radio that I couldn't turn off. WMIND. Oh wait, we're in Omaha. WKMIND. And I also saw how emotions are like weather, you know, continuously happening with clouds and sun and rain and storms and, of course, hurricanes from time to time. And I saw how these thoughts and emotions really tossed me around. And at that point of seeing that so clearly, I became interested in finding some peace and quiet from them. So I became earnestly interested in trying to understand what Buddhism had to say about that and how to do that through meditation. So I started taking courses on Buddhism. And now we come to a rather dark chapter in my life. During the same year, my brother, who is younger by a year, had a nervous breakdown and attempted suicide, a very serious attempt. He was lucky to survive. And this marked the beginning of 5 years of really acute mental illness. He went from being his high school's valedictorian to being zonked out on very heavy psych medications in a locked ward of a hospital. And these were very difficult, intense years for my family. And maybe because I was the oldest, I ended up doing a great deal of the case management for him. And I'm not sure that I would have survived these difficult years without the support of meditation and the understandings from Buddhism. During morning meditation each day, I would connect with the gentle in and out breath, which provided a way to remain calm. Meditation gave me a way to be with very strong emotions like fear and anxiety without letting them overwhelm me. And most importantly, I think, I learned how to be happy even in the midst of suffering. Suffering never goes away. There's always difficulties in life. But I think what matters is learning to relate to that meaningfully. So now, all that I was learning about Buddhism in college wasn't just theory, but a highly relevant and applicable practice, providing a practical approach that both explained and allayed suffering. And this experience in which a crisis or great challenge turns an intellectual understanding of something into a living, breathing practice is very common among many Buddhists I know, especially young Buddhists, a great many say that meditation and Buddhism became more deeply integrated into their lives after a big test, like a breakup, a car accident, a struggle with addiction. And my brother's difficult years certainly were a turning point for me. Let me just say that today, 12 years later, my brother's doing really well. He works for a nonprofit, he got married, and they recently bought a home, so we're really proud of how far he's come. After graduating college, I returned to Barre, Massachusetts, where I had learned Vipassana practice. And some years before, this organization had bought a property next door, which consisted of a 240-year-old farmhouse and some large fields bounded by thick rock walls and a view of a mountain. And this new facility, called the Barre Center for Buddhist Studies, was designed to complement the meditation retreats offered by its parent organization, IMS, by providing courses in the study of Buddhism and housing a really large Buddhist library. If you want to know how big the Buddhist Bible is, it's like at least this big, and two of them, two shelves. The founding of this center suggests that Western Buddhists began to realize that meditation alone was insufficient in developing a deep path to awakening, that some study, some understanding of Buddhist teachings is very important to framing the experiences that come out of meditation practice. The executive director of this center, who had a PhD in Buddhist studies, designed the new meditation hall, and he came up with a style that he calls Shaker Zen. Everyone who visits this center remarks about how beautiful it is, but when the staff members first began sleeping there, they complained that their sleep was being disrupted by ghosts. My friend Susan said she couldn't sleep. And so Jack Kornfield, who is now a very famous Western Buddhist teacher and who had spent years in Thailand as a monk, performed an exorcism on the building. Part of the ceremony was wishing that these ghosts would be able to relinquish their longing for this world and move to a better place. Susan said, and she's a very grounded person, she said she slept much better after that. Every year, another thing that happened at this center, a senior monk who is a white American, ordained in the Thai tradition, came to the center to teach. He abides very strictly by the monastic precepts, such as eating only before noon and taking great care in his interactions with women. One time I wanted to hand him a booklet, and I offered it with two hands, which was the right thing to do. And when I did that, though, he pointed to the table where I placed it. One of his precepts was that he is not allowed to receive things directly from the hands of a woman. I felt very hurt by this because the gesture reminded me that I'm a woman and that the Theravada Code of Ethics, the lineage he's from, regards me as a threat to his monastic vows. And it further bothered me that he, as a Western man, had chosen to adopt a foreign custom that was at odds with the prevailing Western custom of gender equality. And I wouldn't have been offended if it had been a Thai monk who had been raised this way. But, hurt as I was, I also understood that once rules are called into question, what's the limit of that? And moreover, I could see how if he misbehaved, at least by other standards, it would compromise his standing with other Thai Buddhists. Nonetheless, I feel that there are aspects of traditional Buddhism that could use some reexamination, particularly with regards to the treatment and inclusion of women. At the study center, I did everything from plunging toilets to setting out meditation cushions, to chopping piles and piles of onions. as people came to do retreats, I noticed often that I was the youngest there about by 30 to 50 years. And one thing I noticed is that the people who had started in the 70s, who had long hair and big hair, either had gray hair or no hair. But the refreshing thing is it seemed that the people who started many decades ago had stuck with it. And many of the people who have come on retreat here are psychologists, therapists, social workers. And there's continues to be a strong emphasis on meditation as psychology. And in fact, there are courses and retreats. You can even get continuing education credits to meditate, which I think is remarkable. And this really can be seen as a continuation of the way Buddhism as psychology was reconfigured in the early 20th century. After college, I went on to divinity school to study Buddhism and Sanskrit. And one day, I was in a course called Buddhism in America, and in walked the most handsome man ever, but he was a monk, so he was not supposed to get married. So let me tell you a little bit about this man, Ilmi, who was raised in Korea in the 70s. Like me, he was raised more Buddhist than your typical Buddhist because his grandmother owned a small village temple. And just as I had been when I was a kid, he had been embarrassed to be a Buddhist because many of his friends were Christian, and at the time, the cool people were Christian, and Buddhism was for grandmothers. Because his father was a severe alcoholic, home life was really bad, and he dropped out of school. And by the age of 15, he started to get into a lot of trouble. And his uncle, who is a monk as well, noticed that things were amiss and said, "Why don't you go visit a friend of mine who is the abbot of a temple off the south of Korea? It's this beautiful island." And so Ilmi went there, and although the abbot was not noticeably affectionate or kind, he carried himself with respect and was clear and sincere. And so Ilmi remembers thinking, "This is a man I can follow." So at first, the master assigned Ilmi simple tasks around the temple, like cleaning. And he only intended to stay for a week, but he really liked how peaceful and quiet was. And one thing led to another. This is sort of a Karate Kid wax on, wax off story. I'm glad you know wax on, wax off. So the master began him on a daily regimen of bowing and chanting. And sometimes Ilmi would just break down in tears. And I think that this was a sort of a therapy for him. And it was a way of rebuilding himself. And when his weeping ended, then the master began to teach him how to copy Chinese characters out of old texts. And then eventually what those characters said about Buddhist doctrines. And less than a year later, he ordained as a novice monk and was given the name Ilmi. And he remained at the temple for 3 more years. He didn't go to high school. He just took an exam. And this is interesting. Even though he is called a Zen monk, and Zen means meditation, he actually received very little training in meditation. He learned bowing and chanting and scriptures and temple duties and conduct. I don't think he did his first meditation retreat until he went to Germany and did it with Westerners. Eventually, he came to the United States and began his studies at Harvard, where I met him. And for the first few months that we knew each other, we were just friends, and we did activities for the Harvard Buddhist community together. And I was very respectful of him, but at some point, we definitely needed to have a little talk. And within a few minutes of sitting down, he didn't say, "I like you" or "I love you" or anything. He just said, "I thought about getting married and having kids together." So I was like, "Did you aim that arrow?" I had only been ready to show the hand of maybe I like you. But he broke down the wall. So eventually we did get married. And many of our Buddhist teachers and friends, including his master from Korea, attended. And in retrospect, it's not a mystery why we were drawn to each other, because we do share elements of each other's culture. You know, I had absorbed something of the Asian feel for things, I suppose, through my parents' experimentations, and he had absorbed something of the West, partly because Korea is occupied, and there's media, and through his studies and travels. And in our generation, us old folks in our 30s and 40s, we begin to see the hybridization of identities. The mix of cultures and nationalities for those younger than us is even more profound. I'm at Duke, and sometimes you're looking at a face and you have no idea where the face comes from. It's such a blend of ethnicities, and the accents can be very puzzling. I know this Japanese girl who grew up in Hong Kong, so she has a British accent. It's really very interesting. So, for example, in America, you know, you have hundreds of thousands of Americanized Asians and not a few Caucasian Asian children like our own who are exposed to a tremendous breadth of cultural and religious expressions. And so how will they interpret Buddhism? You know, how will that intersect with culture? I think this will have a really profound impact on the future of Buddhism. And indeed, it's getting harder and harder to say East versus West. So if you go to a temple in Korea, you might actually find they offer yoga. Where did they get that idea? From the Westerners. I find that remarkable. So soon after Ilmi and I met, Ilmi took me to the temple where he had worked in upstate New York. And I was quite nervous about visiting an Asian temple. It was my first visit to a non-Western Buddhist center. But I was kind of excited because in this Buddhism in America class, we had learned a lot about the so-called two different styles of Buddhism in America, the ethnic or Asian style and the convert or the American Westernized style. And I had been critical of this distinction because I felt it was disrespectful to Asian Buddhists to call their Buddhism cultural, as if somehow their form of Buddhism was not animated by the same thought and practice as the Westerners. And I also assumed that our shared Buddhist heritage would overcome cultural barriers. Ilmi guided me and the other graduate students who came with us to the Buddha Hall. And boy, was I surprised by the altar. Before us was a dazzling display of color and light and three golden Buddhas with lots of flowers and an array of foods and fruit. And in many Western centers, if there is a Buddha altar at all, it's very minimal. Those in my parents' generation were trying to push away from conventional religion for the most part, and the aesthetic of the centers reflects that aversiveness to religious expression. And I found this altar like way too showy. And the Buddha looked overweight, and I didn't think that the offerings made very much sense because technically Buddhism says the Buddha no longer exists, so why are we making offerings? So this was my first reaction. Over time, I came to appreciate, actually, the beauty of these altars. But the smell of the incense was really lovely, and indeed when I made three bows to the altar, I felt very much at home. The next morning, Sunday, several busloads from Manhattan delivered lay people who flowed directly into the hall and began bowing. And we students stood in the back, expecting that soon we would start meditation. But that's not what happened. Instead, we all began bowing and chanting, and I was pooped by the ninth bow. And more importantly, I was worried that I would hit my head on the butt of the lady in front of me if I didn't time it just right. So even though I had grown up with bowing and chanting, That was just 5% of the time, with 95% of the time spent in meditation. And here, this was completely the reverse. So during lunch, I got to see how the abbot of the temple was both the spiritual head and the administrative head. And I realized that this is pretty much a completely different organizational model than what the Western centers tend to use. Most of them, not all of them, have more of a non-profit administrative system, such as in Barre, Massachusetts, where there's a board of directors, there's a staff with its executive director, and then there's also the teachers, and these three centers of power work together. Whereas in a traditional Asian temple, it's the abbot, and everything comes from that. And that system is very efficient, if the abbot is good. But even monks will complain. Either the abbot has great spiritual depth, but they are a nincompoop when it comes to personnel, or they're very good with administration, but they have nothing to teach. After lunch, we hung around outside, and I got to see the kids playing and the grandmothers playing with the kids and the parents, and I really appreciated the sociability of the temple because, again, you don't find that much in the Western centers. When we got back to Cambridge, even though we had been gone for just 24 hours, I felt like we had been to a completely different country and we had been away a long time. And I began to understand just how different these two Buddhisms were. And I began to feel skeptical that we should try to force these two different styles to come together. Maybe we can from time to time, but, you know, we don't have to push it. Maybe we can wait for another generation where language and culture are not as much of a barrier. And in fact, I will be generously donating two Korean Americans to that new generation, my children. A few years ago, I started to go to a local temple when we lived in Tucson with my daughter Priya, who was then 2.5. And this was a Vietnamese temple that had as the abbot a Westerner. It was a very unusual temple to see Westerner and Asian Buddhists all together. Interestingly, even though within the same temple confines, mostly stayed separate. You know, the Westerners talked with each other and the Vietnamese talked with each other. And we only convened around food. Another mother there approached me one day about starting a Sunday school for kids so that the parents could meditate. So one mother would teach the kids something about Buddhism while the other mother meditated, and then we would alternate Sundays. It was just two of us. But very interestingly, before we knew it, we were joined by the Vietnamese children at the temple. And they also liked learning about meditation and playing games and talking about Buddhism in English, their primary language. You know, and unfortunately, the three Vietnamese nuns who were residents there really didn't take much time with the children. It wasn't their fault, but they were just very, very busy with rituals for the departed and trying to work with the older members. And as well, they weren't fluent in English. And so this is very common in ethnic temples in America, where there's a very big gap between the clergy who tend to be from Asia and the Americanized kids. It's rare that you find a monastic who can bridge the gap there. I don't know whether my children will become Buddhist or not, but I do think that when they come of college age, they will have two options before them, one Buddhist and one Buddhist-inspired. Just as Hatha Yoga has more or less been split off from Hinduism, so too does it seem in many regards that meditation practice is becoming excerpted from Buddhism. I have my own judgments about that, but that's another discussion. There is a huge movement to incorporate a secular form of meditation practice into medicine, education, and psychology. The Mindfulness-Based Stress Reduction Program, or MBSR for short, came out of the University of Massachusetts Medical School about 30 years ago. And this program combines elements of yoga with mindfulness meditation to help patients manage chronic pain. And the program makes no reference to Buddhism or Hinduism, and it's used in hospitals around the country, and it's now being adapted for public schools and in psychiatric and therapeutic settings. Just recently, because I've been doing a lot more teaching on meditation and Buddhism, I became ordained as a lay Buddhist, which is a rather new form of practicing that you don't see much of these days. And unlike my parents and my great-grandfather, I wouldn't hesitate to call myself a Buddhist and to think of it as a religion. And my sense of Buddhism as a religion is not that uncommon among people in my generation. There are young people who ordain as monks and nuns, although whether they remain so will be another question. When my husband and I settled in Durham, North Carolina, about 2 years ago, I looked around for a Buddhist temple or a meditation group like the one in Tucson that could help me with my kids. And unfortunately, there was nothing really that quite suited us. Most Buddhist groups have members who are in a post-family stage of life. Many centers consist primarily of baby boomers. So about a year ago, I decided to start a group called the Buddhist Families of Durham, BFD. The members love that. There are 12 families. But one of the challenges of working with this group of people is that many of the adults have stated very clearly that they don't want to be Buddhist and they don't want their kids to be Buddhist. I don't think they know what they're saying when they say that, but that's what they say. They say they just want to learn meditation to be better parents and to have their kids be nicer. And the parents are very uncomfortable with statues or bowing. One time I suggested maybe we could include a bow. And a mother lashed out that she didn't want her child to she didn't want the child to be taught that she was lower than anybody, including the Buddha. And that mother had been raised in a Catholic home, and so I think she was bruised by some of the history of being in that church. And let's see, I'm also the chaplain for the Buddhist community at Duke. The students are both Westerners and Asian American and mixed. And as a result, the group pulls in two different directions. There are some who want Buddhism and some who want meditation without Buddhism. And my job is to bring us all together. And I really enjoy my time with these young people because they remind me of how this phase of life is full of big questions and worthy dreams. And I feel that Buddhism can answer those questions quite beautifully. So I feel like we have been on quite a journey through history and American society. And I hope that this narrative format has given you a good feel for how Buddhism has been interpreted among the living generations today. And as is true of many things in America, the Buddhist community is highly diverse, rich with a great range of ideas, and has its own strengths and areas for growth. Thank you.
All right, we're going to go ahead and open it up to questions. If people have any questions for Sumi, go ahead and raise your hand, and we'll come on over with the mic.
What is the relationship between the Hindu and Buddhist faith?
Hinduism itself is extremely diverse, but they are fairly distinctive religions. And Buddhism developed in part as a response to Brahmanism, which is an earlier form of Hinduism. At the time, Hinduism said that there is a self that could be united with Brahman, the greater, like the whole universe. And the Buddha said, Not so much. There actually is no self. Can't be united. So the Buddha actually was responding to some of the prevailing philosophies of Hinduism at that time. And so the philosophies are different. However, the meditation practices, particularly with regards to concentration, share some qualities. And today, I mean, it's very interesting because Buddhism is somewhat sourced and premised on Hinduism, and then they diverge, but now you have people doing meditation and yoga.
What do you recommend people who have dabbled into Buddhism meditation and learning it and today when they're asked, what do you believe or what religion are you? So often, you know, being raised Christian, it seemed like you would always refer to as philosophy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, it's been very interesting. My own relationship to Buddhism, is it a philosophy, a practice, a religion, has changed over the years. And right now, I'm kind of coming around to Buddhism is a philosophy and not so much a religion, because it is not premised on the idea of God or gods. And that atheistic premise makes it fundamentally different. So even though I said during the talk that I think of Buddhism as a religion, I do think it is a religion. But I also think in other regards it is not a religion. And as such, I'm coming to see that it is possible for there to be compatibility between being a Christian and doing Buddhist practices. So that wouldn't necessarily make you Buddhist, but the Buddhist practices and thinking is informing your spiritual life. So I think it's fine to say, you know, well, I study Buddhism, I practice meditation, I think it's pretty neat, but I'm Christian. You know, that's my home.
Let's give Sumi a really warm thanks.
You've been listening to a program from Project Interfaith on Noon Forum. We've heard a lecture by Sumi London Kim, chaplain for the Buddhist community at Duke University and author of Blue Jean Buddha and the Buddha's Apprentices. She spoke on the topic Blue Jean Buddha, Tracing the Generations of Buddhism in America. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evening, March 15, 2011, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Beth Katz, Executive Director of Project Interfaith, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.